or call 855-6-ECYCLE. It's easy to e-cycle.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents Vermont Conversations with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. By The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community since 2003. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By Green Mountain Power. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. As well as over 750 VBSR members. Here is David Goodman.
Welcome to this New Year's Eve edition of the Vermont Conversation. We end 2014 by talking with two truth tellers. In the second half of our show, we'll be speaking with Julia Alvarez, the writer in residence at Middlebury College, who's also the winner of the National Medal of Arts this year. But first, we'll spend the first half of our show with Howard Bryant. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN.com and also contributes to ESPN the magazine, ESPN, and ESPN Radio. He's been a reporter for the Washington Post and Boston Herald, among other publications, and his books include The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron, and Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Howard Bryant wrote an article that appeared recently in ESPN the magazine called Sports Stars Are Waking Up. I'll read for you one of the opening paragraphs. He writes, quote, "The awakening of athletes today," and he was referring here to the involvement of athletes in protesting the killings in Ferguson, Missouri, and the killing of Eric Garner in New York. So Howard Bryant writes, quote, "The awakening represents the arrival of the anti-Jordans. The athlete is a living, breathing, thinking citizen and not just a sneaker pitch man. If the aftermath of September 11th politicized the ball field by valorizing American militarism, athletes after the non-indictments in Ferguson and New York now reject the public demand of shut up and play. They see that America, divided by race and class, could not be less, quote, post-racial, a term intended to bury yesterday and soften tomorrow. It's an awakening in which some black athletes see no reward for being dutiful frontmen, for saluting the police as heroes at halftime. They instead see themselves reduced to a pre-racial place, no more American or human for their loyalty, so convinced that black lives don't matter that they've joined the national movement demanding that they do." Howard Bryant, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, how are you? Happy New Year.
Thanks.
Say goodbye to 2014.
Goodbye to 2014. So your article on athletes' response to the killings in Ferguson and New York, and of course since that time we have other places, Cleveland, to add to this list, was certainly one of the most powerful, interweaving both sports and society, which is something you do on a regular basis. What moved you to write this article?
Well, I think the first thing that moved me to even consider this was the actions of the players. And I think social media had a lot to do with it. When you're on Twitter, finally you can hear a little bit more, or Facebook as well, you can hear a little bit more about what the athletes think in their own words, and also what suggestions, what gestures they make to give an idea of what their feelings are. And I think this is important from a player standpoint and also from a fan perspective as well, and people who care about celebrity more than simply the money that the players make, is I think that the real issue here is we never hear from them at all. And the players have been reduced because of their fame, because of their money, because of their brand and the corporatizing of professional sports to be neutral and silent, sometimes by choice and sometimes because their handlers say that it's bad public relations for them to take an issue on anything. So to have this conversation in America occur now starting in Ferguson and continuing on in New York and the other places. And to have the players decide to speak up was news to me. And then I think also what was very interesting wasn't just the remarkable nature of their gestures, which were all fairly minor. I mean, just I think we've been so unused to having any sort of activism from athletes that just making a gesture or putting a notation on your wristbands sparked news. I think it was that, and also the fact that the reaction from the public that wanted them to be quiet, or from the police unions that were so offended by simple gestures, struck me as something to pay attention to.
What, and we sort of skipped over the specifics of those gestures. Tell me what you thought were some of the more striking examples of athletes speaking up about, you know, issues that were not on the ball field.
Well, I think the players that impressed me the most were the ones who were really paying attention to the historical arc. David West, the power forward from the Indiana Pacers, was a really smart guy. And it was obvious that he wasn't simply joining the I Can't Breathe movement with a T-shirt, but almost on a daily basis. His responses to what's taking place in the news, it's obvious that he is reading, that he is a part of the culture. He's not simply making a comment about something that he has no education on. David is just such an intelligent player because he's paying attention not just to Eric Garner or to Mike Brown or Ferguson, but also has historical perspective. And I think that the athletes are important in this because when we're talking about the relationship between the police and at-risk and minority communities, the player, for once, is actually more authentic than most of us because a lot of the players come from these places, especially the black players. And so they've got a unique perspective. They've got a firsthand knowledge that a lot of us that write about this don't have. And that gave them credibility in a way, in fact, sometimes more credibility than the people who are writing the articles. So to hear them speak up made it personal. It wasn't theory for them. It wasn't a conversation to be had that you see sometimes in Hollywood, where you take on celebrity causes, or you take on popular world causes. We're not talking about freeing Tibet here. You're talking about communities where the players actually grew up, have relatives, encountered police on a daily basis, or enough that their perspectives were real.
You contrast today's players, or you describe them as the anti-Jordans, referring to Michael Jordan. What are you referring to there? What did Michael Jordan represent
Michael Jordan represented commerce more than anything else, and a very neutral, and very politically neutral commerce, obviously made famous by not getting involved in a Senate race back in the late 80s, early 90s, I believe, to Jesse Helms' race. And where he said, you know, Republicans buy shoes too. And whether or not he actually used those words has become debatable. But the sentiment was very real, and Michael Jordan embodied that sentiment that I am a pitchman. I am a person who is politically neutral. I have no affiliations. I am a professional athlete. I sell my brand to America. And that's my value. And because Michael Jordan was so good and such an iconic player, a lot of players followed the lead of Jordan. And also not just because he was so good, but also because of the enormous amount of dollars at stake. You're talking tens of millions of dollars in endorsements, and you've got handlers who are telling you that the last thing you want to do is jeopardize that, especially if you're 20, 25 years old. You've got a very small window to earn tremendous amounts of dollars. For example, when LeBron James signed his first contract in 2003 with the Cleveland Cavaliers, even before he signed his contract, he was 18 years old, he signed a $90 million endorsement deal with Nike. So we're talking real dollars here. And the reason why this is important goes all the way back to Jackie Robinson and all the different conversations and Sandy Koufax when you're talking about faith and politics and civil rights. You're talking about these concepts colliding with the enormous dollars at stake at the same time when you have a lot of kids and students and activists who are out there putting their lives on the line as well in terms of protest.
We're talking with Howard Bryant from ESPN and ESPN.com here on the Vermont Conversation. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. And we have a caller on the line, Ken from South Hero. Ken, welcome. Oh, that is a mistake. So we don't have a caller on the line. We can continue with our conversation. So it seems like, you know, the historically, athletes were given a signal, you know, back in 1968, probably the most iconic image of athletes taking a political stand was of Olympic gold medalist Tommy Smith and bronze medalist John Carlos raising their fists in a Black Power salute at the 1968 Summer Olympics. And they were harshly penalized and somewhat banished from sports at that
time.
Not
somewhat banished. They were banished in a lot of ways. They were outcasts. And let's, you know, let's be clear about this, David. I mean, this is the reason why these conversations are so important, the reason why these gestures are so important, is because they underscore something that we really don't want to confront in American culture, which is the still existing gap between the viewpoint of Black America against the mainstream. And every time we believe that we've turned a corner, something like Ferguson happens, or something like the Olympics happens, or something happens that reminds us that maybe we haven't made the sort of progress that we'd like to think that we've made. And so, and especially today, when you have this notion of post-racialism because of the victory of Barack Obama in 2008, we'd like to think that things have improved, but the fact of the matter is that we still have incredible poverty along racial lines, and we have incredible poverty along class lines. And especially, as we know, in Vermont, obviously, it's not a place of high racial diversity, but of certain class diversities and the class and poverty issues in Vermont. People can speak to those even without a racial conversation. So we know that there's not as much progress. We know that people are struggling. And because of those struggles, the relationship between power and the public exists in a racial standpoint and also without a racial standpoint. Class is so underrepresented in these stories.
What do you think is the tipping point now, the things you've described, the enormous sums of money involved with athletes' contracts today, and the specter, you know, that we just spoke about of Black athletes being punished for taking political stands? What changed in 2014?
Well, I think what changed, which is really interesting because of the times that we live in, to me, the biggest change was video, was the fact that when it came to Mike Brown in Ferguson, we can talk about a lot of things, but we really don't know what happened. Nobody really knows what happened. We can talk about the politicization of the grand jury in Ferguson. We can talk about which witnesses saw what, but none of us really know. And then there's Eric Garner. Then there's that video that we all saw, and everyone watched it. And you saw a man who was agitated, who posed no physical threat despite his size. None of those officers were in any danger of him. He wasn't attacking anyone. He was sort of walking away and telling them to leave him alone, but he was not attacking them. And then the police jumped him. They didn't read him his rights. They didn't say, hey, we got to take you in. And they choked him to death on video. And I think everybody looked at that and said, something's wrong here. Even the people who still try to cling to the fiction that the police had no choice but to treat him in this way, there's still a feeling that there was no reason that man had to die that day for selling a 75-cent untaxed cigarette. And I think the players looked at that, and I think the players saw that, you know, we need to say something finally, especially because the players have so much reach with the public, especially with young people as role models, whether they want to be role models or not. They're people that the public follows. I think they felt finally that this was something that had to be reacted to. And I think also the pressure that the players have, especially the African-American players, the pressure that you're getting back home from your brothers and your sisters and your parents and your friends, because they're going through this as well, and also looking on the television and seeing the video of these of these activists, of these people who just get involved, blocking traffic and doing die-ins at supermarkets and in malls. I think that players recognize that, you know, we're citizens too, and this is something that's important to us.
Were you surprised that the NFL and the NBA did not punish the athletes for taking these stands?
No, I was surprised that the NFL didn't. I think they recognized that they really didn't have. I don't think they would have stood on any sort of the right side of the issue had they done something. I think the optics would have been terrible for them. I think that it was more surprising to me the backlash that the players got from the public. I think the real disappointment for me was both the public giving them this sort of shut-up-and-play attitude. And then, of course, the police unions, especially in St. Louis, essentially bullying these players for having opinions. I've never seen any entity as thin-skinned, unable to handle any sort of criticism in any way, any sort of reaction to their actions than the police departments that have acted in these cases.
You've had your own experience as an African-American man with the police, in which you or your lawyer alleged that race was a factor. Can you talk about how your personal experience informs your view on this issue?
Sure. It's not simply a reaction to a single incident. It's a reaction to a lifetime of incidences. And it's not just the incidences. It's not just the fact that I had been put down at gunpoint when I was a teenager in New Jersey, when I was going to college in Philadelphia, or the fact that you have these just bizarre reactions, or encounters with police who are essentially asserting themselves. It's the fact that they do this, but also the fact that once they recognize that you are a person of substance, once they recognize that you're not someone that they can push around from a class standpoint, that then they react differently towards it. Then they treat you more human. They treat you like a citizen. I had an argument with my ex-wife in 2011, and our conversation, we were finished, we were done talking, and I had been arrested and manhandled by the police when I did not resist them and I did not do anything that would suggest to them any sort of hostility. But the force that they had used had really prompted people who had witnessed it to come forward and speak to the handling of me. And then when I got to the police station, what was very interesting about it was once they had found out that I had worked for ESPN, that I was a journalist, and that I was an upstanding citizen, they treated me completely differently. They didn't back down, obviously. They never apologized, obviously. Once the truth came out, they had to back away and leave me alone. But had I not had an upper middle class background, had I not had the money to fight them, had I not had the money to defend my name, my entire career would have been ruined. I think that's the piece of this that is underreported, that is so under-discussed. For me, the racial element was one thing, but the class element was far more powerful because I would have lost everything. It cost me $22,000 to defend my name against them. And the power that they have against average everyday citizens with no accountability, they didn't have to be responsible for police reports that ruined my reputation. And if I didn't have that money, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So when I think about these things, I don't think about them only from a racial standpoint. I think about it from a class standpoint more than anything else.
Howard, do you have children?
I do. And my six-year-old at the time witnessed the entire event, which is one of the reasons why it was so painful for me and so devastating, was because he had to see something he didn't have to see. And I think that's the thing that is so difficult for us across racial lines to understand, which is the attitudes that a lot of law enforcement have when it comes to African Americans. It's the force that they feel that they are licensed to use. It's the force that they seem so willing to use. It's the the lack of community, the lack of conversation. Did you really have to put a guy in a chokehold for selling a cigarette? That's not to say that Eric Garner was innocent of anything. Maybe, you know, he broke the law technically. But does that mean that you have to go 0 to 60? Is this the response, that if you don't obey 100%, then your punishment is death? I think that's the stuff that is really the nuanced conversation. That I think if there were better relations between community and law enforcement, that these things wouldn't happen. There was a time, I remember when we were kids, you know, you had the police athletic league and you knew officers who, you know, were football coaches and basketball coaches, and you saw them at CYO and you saw them around. So you weren't the threat of danger. You were just another kid that they knew. I remember, and what's interesting about it is it is a racial and class thing, because we didn't deal with police at all when I grew up in Dorchester in Boston. At all. We saw them. I was a really little kid anyway, so I don't remember any real relationships, except there was an African-American officer who lived across the street from me. But when my family moved to Plymouth, the police were everywhere. You know, they were coaches, they were part of the community, and you remembered them, and they saw you, and they gave you some dispensation. I did some really stupid stuff when I was a kid. I was the only black kid in my group, and some friends of mine, when I was in high school, you know, we were zooming down the street with a machine gun water gun before they made Super Soakers. It actually looked like an Uzi. And we were squirting people out the window and got stopped by the cops, and they grabbed us. I mean, today we all could have gotten shot. They might have shot the entire car up. And so it's a really interesting thing in terms of the policing and the attitude. You have to know your community so you're not afraid of them.
One of the most powerful lines in your recent article, and we're talking to Howard Bryant from ESPN, you write, "For African Americans, race is personal all day, every day, legally and emotionally, the defining characteristic of our American existence. For whites, race is often but a topic, one to be debated and engaged or dismissed as whining and tabled for another day." I'm curious, you know, in your daily work as a reporter for ESPN, you go on these talk shows and TV panels where there's a lot of banter. You know, as you write, this is something that goes to the core of your daily experience, yet for your colleagues in talking about issues like race and sports, it's pretty optional whether they talk about it. How do you deal with that in that public, you know, back and forth setting? How do you explain to them what's going on for African Americans and African American athletes?
Well, I think you choose your words really carefully. That's the first thing. But I think the second thing that you have to do is you have to turn the tables and really talk about structure. I think you have to talk about, to me, when I think about those sentences and those words that I wrote, it always comes back to the same thing, which is the colossal failure of integration. That we don't have integration in this country. What we have is we have a few African-American families who have done well and have drive and have ambition and have the ability to take that ambition and do something financially with it and move into white society. And that small number of us, we get to go forward. We get to succeed. I may not have been the most talented person in my neighborhood in Boston or the most ambitious, but I came from a two-parent household, and my parents both worked, and they had the money to get us out of the ghetto, and we got to go to school with white kids, whether I was in Boston in the Metco program or when we moved to Plymouth. And I think about my existence as an African-American in this country, and almost every piece of opportunity started with one thing: getting away from other black people. Getting away from black society and being integrated into white society, having the opportunity, that's where the opportunity comes from. So what happens to the rest of us who don't have that opportunity? You're stuck in the ghettos, you're stuck in poor neighborhoods, you're stuck with no opportunities. And that's where these conflicts come from. I think about Ferguson or Eric Garner, and I think about the most affluent African Americans' relationships with the police are probably far, far better. So we're still, once again, talking about money. We're not even talking about race necessarily. And so, to answer your question, what I always talk about is the failure of real integration. How many African Americans do we know? How many have been to your table? How much of that world are you actually exposed to? And then I also ask myself the other questions as well, which is, what do we do with those people if we don't know them? How then do you explain the community relationship if you have no connection to those communities? Essentially, what you have then is your experience with the police, which is extremely difficult, extremely different, rather. What you have is your relationship with a society that treats you as part of the family, whereas in Ferguson and these other places, you feel occupied. It's a really hard place to reach if you don't know it. And I think the thing that I've always told people, and I've been in the business a quarter century now, I feel old, I always say that the difference between black and white in this country is that you can be white and live an entirely good, happy, prosperous, successful life and not necessarily know anybody African American and not know their experiences. But there is not a black person in this country that has any sort of success at all that doesn't have to know how to live and survive and navigate the white world. That's just how it is. You know, we talk about everything else in this world. We talk about, you know, maybe you're taller than I am, or you came from a better place, or I came from a better place. And we talk about, you know, some people get to go to college and some people don't. And why? And what do we say? We say life isn't fair. And that's how we all grew up. Life isn't fair. But when it comes to race, we always want to try to make it equal. But it's not. It's just as unfair as everything else.
So you've talked about how when black athletes speak out about political issues of the day, they get told, some are getting told to shut up and play. You, as an African-American journalist writing about these issues in a sports context, do you get pushback, essentially told to shut up and write about the ball game?
Sure. I mean, and let's face it, depending on how old you are, if you remember a lot of the civil rights movement in the 60s, which I don't remember, I wasn't born, but I do remember the 70s and the 80s when you had the backlash to that with affirmative action and everything else, and busing in Boston when I was a kid. The attitudes from the public was no news on the sports page. We watch the ball game for the ball game. We don't want to hear about your politics. We don't want to hear about how, you know, what, you know, what Kurt Flood feels about the world, or what Reggie Jackson feels, or what any ball player feels. We don't want to hear that. We want your talent to entertain us. That's why we're watching the game on Sunday. And then 9/11 happened. And post 9/11, you can't go to a ball game without being inundated with politics. You can't watch television. You can't watch a sporting event without having some sort of military tie-in or some sort of police, honoring police tie-in. So sports have become so completely politicized now that it was refreshing to me that the players felt that they could speak up. And I look at it this way. My job is to write about these issues. My job is to talk about things that people are talking about and to talk about the attitudes that I have as a columnist. What are your opinions? If you don't do that, if you allow yourself to be intimidated by a public that doesn't want to hear what you have to say, you're not doing your job. I respond to people quite constantly. There are other people to read. Feel free to read somebody else. But this is my opinion. Here is why I write what I write. Here's why I feel what I feel. And to me, that has to be enough. They put me at ESPN and at the Washington Post and everywhere else I've worked. They put me in these positions to do exactly this. So that's what I do.
Okay, well, Howard Bryant, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation, and Happy New Year.
My pleasure. Have a great 2015.
Okay. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN.com and a contributor to ESPN the magazine, as well as ESPN and ESPN Radio.